Broadcasting live from atop the Rocky Mountains, the crossroads of the West. You are listening to the Liberty Roundtable Radio Talk Show.
All right. Happy to have you along, my fellow Americans. Sam Bushman live on your radio. This is the broadcast for November the 22nd in the year of our Lord, 2022. This is hour two of two, and the goal always to protect life, liberty, and property, to promote God, family, and country, and to do so on your radio and the traditions of our founding fathers. Wow, folks, yesterday we had an incredible program. We had on Dr. Scott Bradley first, freedomsrisingsun.com, and we talked about the doctrine of the lesser magistrates, a proper resistance to tyranny, and a repudiation of unlimited obedience to civil governments, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very good book. I think the general premise of the book is indeed correct. However, I want to be very clear. The doctrine of lesser magistrates is to defy tyrants. The lesser magistrate doctrine teaches that when the superior or higher, quote, ranking civil authority makes, quote, unjust slash immoral law, policy, or court opinions, the lower or the, quote, lesser ranking civil authority has both the God-given right and the duty to refuse obedience to that, quote, superior authority, and if necessary, to actively resist the superior authority. Here's the problem with that idea. The principle generally morally is true, all right? But the problem that I have with it is we need to realize that this civil authority perceived viewpoint is what I'm taking issue with, all right? The general government, the President of the United States, is assumed the highest authority in the land. That's completely backwards, folks. The government that's closest to the people has the highest authority. Remember, the creature is not greater than the creator. The creation is not greater than the creator. The tail does not wag the dog. So the state created the general government. Therefore, the general government is lesser, even though we perceive it as higher, right? In that, quote, civil authority. So my point is we're mixed up. Whenever we need to discuss authority, God is the ultimate, the supreme, the sovereign, the ultimate authority. Man is a creation of God. Man created governments, a contract with each state having a state constitution and the general government having a general constitution. So since man created these contracts, delegating limited authority to different branches and different jurisdictions, we remain in charge. So the greatest authority is God. Man is next. Government is next, but the government that governs closest to the people, states, for example, created the general government. There's no way the general government can be greater than the creator, the states, and or the people, and or God that created them all. So my only problem with that doctrine is that we fall into this lie and accept the greater and lesser magistrate. I reject that notion on its very face, but I get the point. In the book's introduction, the author describes the three boxes that the founding fathers established in order to preserve liberty and resist tyranny. The ballot box to remove, quote, unjust rulers. We got the jury box, not only the judge to judge the facts of a case, but the jury box is also to judge the law itself and to determine whether it's being misapplied or is unjust or immoral. And the cartridge box to allow an armed citizenry not only to repel a foreign enemy, but also to put a check on government to act against tyranny from our own government officials. But those are not the only tools that we have at our disposal, according to the founding fathers, ladies and gentlemen. So we need to be very understanding of this lesser magistrate doctrine. God is the supreme magistrate, ladies and gentlemen. Let's be very clear on that. And let's also be very clear on the simple reality check that we, the people, are created by God. And we, the people, created governments. And they derive their just power from the consent of the governed. That's us. So let's not get confused on the higher or lower civil authority and that the lesser power can act. Yes, that's true in a fundamental moral point of view. Whenever you align yourself with God, you become the moral high ground. but let's be very clear about where authority really comes from and who really has authority. Dr. Murray Sabrin is with us now, and I want him to be able to chime in. I don't know if you heard all that, doctor, but I want to kind of get your opinion about that.
Well, thank you, Sam, for inviting me on this beautiful day here in Southwest Florida. I know the rest of the country is suffering under a lot of snow, and here it's 77 degrees. So since Thanksgiving is a couple days away, I'm very thankful for being in a warm climate.
Amen. And you're also thankful for being in the greatest country on the face of the earth.
Well, this is what I write about in my new autobiography. This is the land of opportunity. When we came here in 1949, I was a two-year-old with my older brother, who was 4 years older than I am. And my parents were the only ones who survived the Holocaust, and they made a life for themselves and for us so we could live in peace.
Let's talk about that, because that's what your whole latest book is about. And it chronicles who you are, kind of your family, how you got here, what you've experienced, the whole gamut, right?
Well, I'm very proud of this because it covers my first 50 years from 1949, when I was 2 years old, to 1997, when I became the Libertarian Party candidate for governor in New Jersey. And I became the first third-party candidate to raise enough money to get the matching funds from the state election commission, which they had a matching fund program back then. They still do. And I was in three debates with the two major party candidates. And it was an incredible experience, since I never debated anyone in my life, let alone a sitting governor and a sitting mayor and senator. Back then, New Jersey politicians tended to have two hats, either in the state legislature and the local county official. And there was one individual, believe it or not, Sam, he had three government positions. He was assistant superintendent of schools. He was mayor of the town that he lived in. And he was also a state senator. You talk about triple dipping. I mean, this and his pension is probably somewhere in the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And this is why the American people are upset with what we have in Washington and their state capitals, because it's all about grabbing as much money as they can for themselves and their cronies. And that's why people are upset. And that's why we have such polarization in America. And so what I'm trying to do in my retirement years now is to sort of shed the light on what's gone wrong in America, since America is a lot different than when I first came here in 1949, where we didn't have this intrusive big government, although the New Deal was in place since the 1930s. And then, of course, the Great Society kicked in the 1960s. And I think it's been all downhill since then in terms of policy. But the wonderful thing about America, and this is something I stress constantly, is that despite all the things that government throws at entrepreneurs, men and women who go every single day to open up their little shop on Main Street to create a new business in rural America or suburban America, and big corporations are doing their thing, the American people are the beneficiaries of all the great achievements of entrepreneurs throughout American history. And that's what makes America such a great place.
When you got here, you were just little, right?
I was just 2.5 years old with long blonde hair. That hair has long receded. And when we arrived in America on a boat 7 days across the Atlantic Ocean, we were met at the New York City Pier on the west side of Manhattan by the Hudson River with by my mother's aunt and uncle from Paterson, who came to America, I think, after World War One. And they were in there, I guess, in their 40s back then, maybe even in their 50s. And my mother was holding me as a two-year-old, getting off the boat. And my mother's aunt says to her, you wrote me saying you had two boys. What are you doing carrying this little girl with you? And so she had to explain that she never cut my hair. And there I had this long blonde hair. And I could have been the Gerber baby if they had pursued that.
All right, there you have it. You don't remember coming much, do you?
No, I don't remember at all. I do remember my father telling me, since the voyage was somewhat rocky, I guess, he said I clung to him for the whole trip. He said I just stayed with him, and I stayed with him. I didn't get sick, according to him. And so I got my sea legs at a very early age, crossing the Atlantic in 1949. And And he was so grateful to come to America because his mother grew up in America. I didn't realize that till years later when he told me about his parents. His mother was taken by his great aunt, her aunt, to America, I think in the 1890s, when she was 5 or 6 years old, grew up in Manhattan, and then decided to go back to her native Poland. And of course, she ra got married, raised a family, and perished during the Holocaust. So it's amazing how one decision can have such enormous consequences in a person's life. And so if she had stayed in America, I probably wouldn't have been born, my father probably wouldn't have been born, and she wouldn't have died in the Holocaust. So it's just amazing how things turn out in life because of one decision. And that decision was to return to Poland when she was, I guess, a teenager in about 1910, because my father was born in 1914. I think he was the oldest of five or six children, and they all perished. I grew up asking questions constantly of my parents about their experiences during World War II. What was it like growing up in Poland in the 1920s and 30s? And you compare what life was back then, 100 years ago, to life today, and our living standards have increased exponentially since then.
Ladies and gentlemen, Murray Sabrin with us from the immigrant son of Holocaust survivors to an American libertarian icon. We'll talk about that personal story and his life in seconds on Liberty Roundtable Live.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
Do you treasure your liberty? Well, at lovingliberty.net, we most certainly do. And we want to help protect your liberty too. Become part of the family. Everyone knows that the core of any society is the family. Therefore, the government should foster and protect the integrity of its family, we the people. Won't you join us as a Loving Liberty sponsor to help us promote the principles in the 5,000-year leap? Let's restore the miracle that changed the world at lovingliberty.net.
Can a nation conceived in liberty carry its head high if it denies protection to the youngest and most vulnerable of its citizens? Can a country founded on God-given rights continue to thrive without understanding that life is a precious gift from our Creator? As a physician, I have looked into the eyes of one-pound babies. I have cradled their small bodies in the palm of one hand. I defy those who are careless, who would disregard life and look at these tiny little miracles and say, we're not going to protect that.
But I believe there will come a time when we are all judged on whether or not we took a stand in defense of all life from the moment of conception until our last natural breath. One thing I promise you, I will always take a stand for life.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Murray Sabrin. We're talking about his autobiography. We're talking about from the immigrant son of Holocaust survivors to an American libertarian icon. You want to learn more, murraysabrin.com. He talks about a ton of topics, folks, but in summation, it's this. Dr. Sabrin understands and communicates how libertarianism can save America. And it's really your growing up and the education that you got from your parents about other countries, about other ways of life, contrast with America and the ways of life, and the changes that you've seen during your life that kind of culminate the man and the message, right?
Exactly right, Sam. I appreciate that. Growing up and asking my parents, when I became aware that I didn't have any grandparents, I didn't have any aunts or uncles, I didn't have any first cousins. And I try to understand why that happened. And they talked about the war. I don't remember exactly when I first asked them about World War II and their experiences. But what was remarkable when I spoke to my parents, and this takes place over many, many decades from the time I was, I guess, in a late elementary school, fifth, sixth grade to junior high school to high school. There was never any bitterness in their recounting of their experiences during World War II, which I found incredible that here a regime, the Hitler regime, wiped out their families and they had no bitterness at all. In fact, in 1992, 30 years ago, exactly 30 years ago, my wife and I took a vacation to Germany, a bus tour of Germany. This was after the wall came down, so we went into East Germany as well. And we went to where the Berlin Wall was, and we saw parts of it there. And when I told my father we're going to Germany for a vacation, he said, you've got to go to the town that you were born in right outside of Munich. And we did make it to Munich on the bus tour, but we couldn't get to the town that I was born. And interestingly enough, several years later, the town that I was born was mentioned on ABC's national news as one of the great spas of the world. Bad Wörishofen is the name of the town. And I still have my original birth certificate that my father gave me that talks that mentions Bad Wörishofen, mentions his name, my name. And of course, my name was not Murray when I was born. It was Moses. That was the Hebrew name that they gave me. And so I like to tell people, kid them, that I hope that I can take the Americans to the promised land.
And that happens through understanding our founding fathers. That happens through understanding the difference between the United States and literally all other nations, Doctor.
Well, this is another interesting aspect of my life. In 1954, 5 years after we arrived in America, my parents became U.S. citizens. And they had to go, I think it was to Lower Manhattan. We were living in the Bronx at the time. To take the oath of being a citizen. And I remember I was, how old was I then? I was 7 years old at the time. This was right before my eighth birthday. And I was with my younger brother, who was a year and a half old, my older brother. And we were staying, I think my parents' friend came to watch us as we were waiting for them to come back from their swearing-in ceremony. And what I remember of that day, this is November 1954, Sam, and I remember they had to pass an exam to become a U.S. citizen. You know, they asked you basic questions about the founding fathers, and other questions about America. And I'm saying to myself, as a seven-year-old, what if they don't pass the exam? Are we going to be deported to Germany or Poland? And I was a nervous wreck that day because certainly I only knew about America. I didn't know anything about Germany, where I was born, or Poland, where my parents were from. And so when they came home, I asked my father, what type of questions did they ask you? And he said, well, who's the first president of the United States? Well, I knew that, George Washington, some other questions. I knew all the questions. And then 5 years later, I became a U.S. citizen. And I raised my right hand to swear an oath to uphold the Constitution. And I started reading the Constitution of what it meant to for the supreme law of the land to say regarding the relationship between the citizenry and the government. And I can tell you, Sam, the Bill of Rights is a libertarian pronouncement of what government should or should not do. The First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, and all the other amendments really explain in layman's terms what it means to live in a free society. Unfortunately, since 1959, Congresses and presidents since then have really defied the Constitution, have turned their back on our basic rights as U.S. citizens, and that's why we're in the mess that we are today with the Patriot Act, with endless wars, with endless money printing, with a run-amok welfare state. And so we live basically in a post-constitutional America because the people who took an oath to uphold the Constitution, even Supreme Court members, have turned their back on the American people's fundamental rights. And that's why I, as an immigrant, I'm so upset with native-born Americans who didn't have to take an oath to the Constitution, and the politicians who did take an oath to the Constitution have really turned America not into the land of the free and the home of the brave, but a status society where the government basically rules everything, and we have to go back to first principles in order to restore the American people's liberties that the founders gave us.
Let's talk about the chapters of your book, because it's a personal story, but it's also kind of an understanding of communicating libertarianism. But it's also an understanding of how we've turned our backs on the principles that make America great. But it's also a story of a German-born American, because you became a citizen, professor of finance. This is a riveting story because it touches on so many topics.
Well, Sam, my journey began, I guess, in elementary school, junior high school, when my favorite subject was social studies, because I was really fascinated with history, geography. And one of the best gifts I ever got was in my bar mitzvah, December 1959, when I turned 13. And young Jewish boys have the ritual of becoming a man with the bar mitzvah ceremony. And we had the celebration in our apartment in the Bronx. And one of the gifts I got, Sam, was an oversized atlas of the world with every country, with every aspect of geography. And I was just fascinated seeing where the United States was in relationship to Europe and in relationship to Asia and Africa, South America. And I was a geography minor as an undergraduate and a history major, because my goal was to become a social studies teacher. I decided that in high school, that I wanted to really give students a great appreciation of the country that they live in and the world that they live in. And what better way to do with it to teach social studies? And so I started to teach social studies in 1968, one of the tumultuous years in New York City public school history, because we had strikes in the early part of the year. And it was a very contentious time as a new teacher. And the second year, I didn't teach social studies. I had to teach math, which I was pretty good at, since I got a pretty good math education in high school and college. And I said, I really don't want to do this for the rest of my life. So that's when I decided, with my wife's support, to get a PhD in geography, to teach geography at the college level. And through a very circuitous route, I end up teaching economics and finance full time for 35 years at Ramapo College, because I developed the skills throughout my career in economic research, economic analysis, financial analysis, investment analysis. And this is what I instilled in my students teaching, is that your education doesn't stop when you get a piece of paper that says bachelor's degree or master's degree or PhD. You're constantly learning about new ideas, new processes in business, and revised history. And of course, today is the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. So I was fascinated with that, seeing that in real time, remembering the day that Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. And I was incredulous that a president could be assassinated in America, given all the protection that the president has. And of course, the narrative back then, if you recall, was that it was a lone nut, Lee Harvey Oswald, who defected to Russia and then came back to the United States. And I did a lot of reading about it. And there's a wonderful blog post on lewrockwell.com by Charles Burris, who was a history teacher, with all the links to research about the Kennedy assassination. And he points out that this was a coup d'etat against President Kennedy, because he wanted to have peace with the Soviet Union after the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. And again, having lived through that, then we nearly came to a nuclear war in October 1962. And that really helped shape my view of war and peace. And again, having the experience of learning about World War II from my parents, and then seeing what was going on in the world with the tension between the Soviet Union and the United States, I said peace has to be the foremost policy of America.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Murray Sabrin with me. And Murray is a German-born American professor of finance. Now, he's written an incredible autobiography. He just released it, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. We'll talk about it more in seconds on your hard-hitting, most favorite talk station.
Your daily Liberty Newswire. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
You USA Radio News with Lance Pry.
One of the country's largest railroad unions said that its members voted to reject a new wage deal brokered by the White House and move closer to a strike as soon as December. Union members said Monday they believe that a compromise could still be reached to avoid a work stoppage that would disrupt distribution. 4 out of 12 unions have now rejected the proposal contract. 8 have ratified the deal. Reality TV stars Todd and Julie Chrisley were sentenced Monday to lengthy prison terms after being convicted earlier this year on charges including bank fraud and tax evasion. A U.S. district judge in Atlanta gave Todd Chrisley 12 years in prison plus 16 months of probation. Julie got 7 years behind bars and 16 months of probation. It's been more than a week since 4 University of Idaho students were found slain. Since then, the Moscow Police Department and other agencies investigating the quadruple homicide has said this will be a lengthy process. A federal judge has ordered Amazon to stop retaliating against employees engaging in unionizing activities. The ruling came in a court case brought by the National Labor Relations Board, which sued Amazon in March seeking the reinstatement of Gerald Bryson, who was involved in organizing a company warehouse on Staten Island, New York. Some old embryos have become new babies. Katie Lewis from our Midwest Bureau explains.
An Oregon couple is celebrating twins that are likely to be the longest frozen embryos to result in a live birth. When Rachel Ridgway gave birth on Halloween, her healthy twins came courtesy of embryos donated 30 years ago. Parents Rachel and Philip used a faith-based National Embryo Donation Center to help grow their family of 4 other children, all born by natural conception.
We are USA Radio News.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along, which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/free. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So, while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/free. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free. ZipRecruiter.com/free.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Dr. Murray Sabrin. Just released his autobiography, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. And really being this public intellectual, this incredible libertarian, helping people understand that, you know what, libertarianism can save America. The principles, the founders, had a lot of libertarian elements in them. Doctor, I want to kind of help people understand this as well. You're Jewish, right?
Absolutely.
And not a lot of Jewish people, I don't know, Jewish religion, it's not really focused on libertarianism, right? How'd you get that combination? Because that's a unique story in and of itself, I think.
Well, if you look back at some of the great free market economists of the past 100 years, they were Jewish. Ludwig von Mises, Milton Friedman, Murray Rothbard, and others, and contemporary economists like Walter Block from New Orleans and from via Brooklyn. So there are a whole bunch of Jewish and Italian libertarians, Austrian school economists, free market economists who understand economics because Mises paved the way in the late 19th, early 20th century with his writings, living in Europe during the heyday of high culture in Austria, in Austria and Vienna. He saw what was happening with the ideas of socialism diffusing through the European continent. And of course, and then he saw, he served in the horror of World War One, and then saw what was going on with Russia with the takeover by the communists, And in 1922, 100 years ago, his magnificent book was published entitled Socialism, where he pointed out to create a socialist society is impossible because in order to have goods and services desired by people, you need to have a free market economy. And he just demolished in 900 pages every aspect of the socialist theory of how it would create a wonderful society. And so for that, he should have won a Nobel Prize in economics, plus his 1912 book on money and credit, which I read before while I was in graduate school in the 1970s, describing how money develops in a free society, why it's important to have gold as the premier money in our society, and that paper money is basically a substitute for gold. It isn't money itself. And so his student, Murray Rothbard, in 1974, wrote this wonderful pamphlet, monograph that's available free at the Mises.org website, What Has Government Done to Our Money? And from that and his other writings, I developed my dissertation topic at Rutgers and how money spreads through the economy and affects local regions. And so that was my contribution to inflation and monetary theory, that it's a process that takes place step by step, that it impacts local communities differently than other communities. And we're seeing this in the data today, where the housing market has been on fire in certain communities, which has raised the price inflation in the South, especially Tampa, Arizona, where people are flocking to from the rest of the country because of COVID and other restrictions. And so so I was able to use the data to show that this is exactly how inflation works. It works step by step, and it hurts the very people that the policymakers say they support, low-income folks, senior citizens, blue-collar workers. These are the people that are hurt by high prices. There's an article in the local paper today how Thanksgiving dinner is going to be so much more expensive than last year. People are substituting products that are less expensive than the traditional Thanksgiving dinner. This is all the result of the Federal Reserve creating trillions of dollars in 2020 because of COVID lockdowns. And this is why government policies never achieve their stated goals of sustainable prosperity, because you need a free market for entrepreneurs to gather the resources together, to make sure that they know what consumers want. That's why marketing is such important and market research is so important, and have a society where consumers are satisfied, entrepreneurs make profits, and this process continues over time. So each generation has their living standards increase because of all the capital that's been invested to improve society. I look back at my own lifetime in the past 50, 60 years, there have been incredible advances in technology and other aspects of our life, and prices have come down. In fact, when I was a little kid, Sam, in the 1950s, when color TV was first introduced into the market, I was in elementary school, and I said, why would anyone buy a color TV right now when it was like $1,000 or more back in the 1950s? That's like $10,000 today. And intuitively, I said, when a new product is introduced, it'll eventually come down as production gears up and you have more supply. And as demand increases, supply will increase faster than demand, and prices will come down as they perfect the techniques of production. That's exactly what's happened in our lifetime with all these high-tech gadgets. Our first color TV when we were married was in 1970. We paid $320 for this big, bulky TV that you needed an antenna on the roof of the apartment building to get any service. And now for $320, you could probably get a 50-inch TV that is high definition, whose picture quality is probably a million times better than what I had in a 25-inch TV in 1970.
That's why you came up with the term the Federal Reserve sucks.
Well, you've got really it think, because...
I really think that highlights the truth that people need to understand. We can have somewhat of a boom and bust economy. We can pretend that it's going well, and temporarily, at least, it can feel good with the sugar high or the cocaine high of kind of the Federal Reserve stimulating the economy. But it's all going to come back to haunt us. The only real answer is honest money. And you highlight that better than anybody with the simple phrase, the Federal Reserve sucks.
Yeah, well, that book was written when I was on sabbatical in my final years at Ramapo College, and it came out 3 years ago. And then my other book came out a year ago, Navigating the Boom Bust Cycle for Entrepreneurs and the General Public to See Where We Are in the Cycle. And a year ago, I wrote an article predicting that there'd be a major recession in 2023. And that looks exactly where we're headed in 2023, when a lot of these well-known economists and talking heads are saying the recession's coming next year. Well, I wrote about that a year ago because the handwriting was on the wall. Once the Federal Reserve creates all this money and keeps interest rates artificially low, they're going to generate an unsustainable boom, which then has to be corrected by a bust to get the economy back onto an even keel. And that's what we're seeing right now. Companies are laying off people left and right. Unemployment is still relatively low because the service sector is still doing fairly well, but it's the high tech sector that's that was inflated beyond its capability to be sustainable, and now it's correcting. That's what a recession is all about: correcting the mistakes of the boom. And the Austrian School of Economists explained that beautifully in so many books and articles over the last 100 or so years. And so I picked up that theme in the 1970s and wrote a dissertation about that. And I've been writing about that ever since. And so I think it's important for the American people to realize it's not Biden's inflation, it's not Trump's inflation, it's the Federal Reserve's inflation. And they're the ones that cause it, because they have the power of the printing press. They have, as I like to explain to people, an unlimited checking account. Can you imagine, Sam, having an unlimited checking account? If the Federal Reserve wants to buy $1 trillion of government debt, they can do so today by just entering a few punches into the computer, and they can buy the debt from the selected government securities dealers who have treasury securities and other securities that the Fed could buy on their balance sheet, and they could be transferred to the Federal Reserve. And where does the Federal Reserve get the money to buy it? They just create it out of thin air. We mortals, Sam, we have to work for a living. We don't have an unlimited checking account. We have to be productive so people buy our goods and services, and everyone is a win-win. Everyone gets a win-win. But when the Federal Reserve creates money, the people who benefit are the people who are the early recipients of that money. And that's usually the banking sector, the financial sector, because we had this huge stock market and bond market boom, which busted this year. And of course, all the recipients of government spending, the military industrial complex and others who benefit from the trillions of dollars that the federal government spends every year. So we have a lot of work to do to get America back to the vision of the founders, which is limited government, personal responsibility, and a free enterprise economy, and peace around the world. As George Washington and Thomas Jefferson said, we should have commerce with everybody, because that's going to be a way to have peace, because it's very hard to have commerce when the bombs are flying, as we see in the Ukraine right now. So I've been adamant in my support for a peaceful foreign policy. I was opposed to all these wars that the undeclared wars that the United States has engaged in. And being in college during the Vietnam War, that was a total disaster, because Johnson and the military industrial complex wanted it, and they got it. And as they say, the rest is history. We've been living with these undeclared wars for now, since the Korean War, for 80 years.
This is getting too good. Hang on, doctor. Ladies and gentlemen, let's skip the break for a second. All right, there you have it. We're talking to Dr. Murray Sabrin, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about his autobiography. It's incredible. MurraySabrin.com. If you want to learn more about what he's doing, about his tremendous books, his professorship, his experience, how he was a German-born economist, American professor of finance, and how he came to America, what he's learned by being here, how he understands and educates about the importance of how libertarianism can save America. And I want to highlight this. You know, the Federal Reserve sucks, folks. And he is the author of a book, Why the Federal Reserve Sucks. And that's really important to understand. You can check out that book. You can also check out his just-released autobiography, folks, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. It's great understanding what this land produces. When people come from other places and realize the genius of the Founding Fathers, realize the brilliance of a free market, free enterprise system, and realizing the Federal Reserve sucks. Now, Do you expect, I know Ron Paul wanted to audit and end the Fed. I support him a gazillion percent in that reality. Audit the Fed, prosecute the criminals, and then end the Fed is what we need to do. Do you think you'll ever see that happen in our lifetime, or will they just take us to war, Doctor?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. When I first started learning about the Federal Reserve and its impact on the economy and read a tremendous amount about financial and economic history of the last 200 years, it seemed to me, and it still seems to me, that the way this is going to end is when foreign holders of dollars and U.S. Treasury securities say enough is enough. And I think we're starting to see that process. The Chinese, I think, have announced that they're not going to buy much more government debt, if at all. Other countries are getting very nervous about the debt of the United States government and the constant printing of money. They're holding dollars that are being depreciated in value. And so they're getting very, very concerned about where the financial future of America is headed. And so if foreigners decide no longer to hold dollars and start cashing them in, which is, by the way, what nearly happened in 1979, 1980, when we were very close to a total dollar collapse, and then Volcker became Fed chair, he raised interest rates to attract dollars to America, and the dollar was saved, and the American economy went into a steep recession that cleared out a lot of the inflation of the late 1970s under Jimmy Carter. And so we had a big boom in the 1980s and 90s. But now the U.S. economy is not as strong as people think it is, even though the unemployment rate is low. So the Federal Reserve will continue to do what it does, which is pump money in, pump money out, keep on manipulating interest rates until foreigners say enough is enough. And then what will happen is the U.S. government will either have to cut spending dramatically to get the budget into balance, or they're just going to flood the economy with money, and the Treasury will take over, and the Federal Reserve will just flood the economy with money to prop everything up. And that's when you could have a runaway inflation like you had in Germany in the early 1920s. So there are so many possible scenarios that that could happen over the next 10, 20 years. So the question is, how much longer can the Federal Reserve continue to prop up the U.S. economy with cheap money? And I think it's going to be a rough haul this decade. In fact, there's a good possibility that, given what I observed in American financial history, that the end of this decade, 2029, is the 100th anniversary of the stock market crash of 1929. And if you look at the data, there have been these 100-year cycles in American history that is quite fascinating. I don't know the explanation for it. I just observed it. The panic of 1819, the forgotten depression of 1920, the implosion of the COVID economy in 2020, the panic of 1873, the oil crisis of 1973. So we've had these 100-year cycles. The panic of 1907, the Great Recession of 2007, 2008. So when I look at financial history, which I taught for many years, and I see these 100-year cycles, I say, what is going on here? I don't know what explains it. All I know is the next possible 100-year cycle event could happen in 2029, 100 years after the crash of 1929, which ushered in a decade-long depression. So we'll see what happens. But in the meantime, people have to be nimble in their own personal finances to keep their head above water, because prices don't seem to be coming down right away. They may come down if they have a steep recession next year and in 2024. And if that happens, it's good to have a lot of cash on hand, because then you could buy probably a lot of cheap stocks, which some people did in 1933 when the market had declined 89%. And some people made a fortune in the 1930s and 40s because they bought stocks at the rock bottom low of 1933.
Ron Paul just wrote an incredible column that I find fascinating when you talk about the boom and bust and the cycles, etc. And the headline of his column by Ron Paul is called A Tale of Two Midterms. And he talks about the midterm of 2010 versus the midterm of 2022. In 2010, he says the Liberty Movement's focus was and is on restoring constitutional government in all areas, ending our, quote, interventionist foreign policy, and changing our monetary policy by auditing and eventually ending the Federal Reserve, and legalizing alternative currencies so there's free market competition. He says this time around, though, the Republicans didn't do anything like that. They didn't articulate a mission, a plan, a go-ahead. They didn't do what they should have done, and that's why the big loss and the big change and the big difference. And he highlights that to articulate where we need to go, Doctor.
Yeah, I thought the Republicans were going to win at least 36 seats. I just took that number out at random because in 1966, right after Johnson got us heavily involved in Vietnam and the economy was heading south, the Republicans picked up, I think, 47 seats in 1966. And then we know 2 years later, Johnson announced he was not going to run for re-election because the Vietnam War was going poorly. Inflation was accelerating. Spending was out of control in Washington. And so the Republicans didn't have a message. And unfortunately, Donald Trump didn't take the high road after 2020, like Nixon did after 1960, when there were allegations that election was stolen from Nixon in 1960, who then lost the governorship of California in 1962. And people wrote his political obituary. But what Nixon did was he went around the country helping elect Republicans, and in 1968, he got the nomination and squeaked by Hubert Humphrey to win the presidency in 1968, after everyone thought Nixon was a goner because of his two losses in the early 60s. So Trump, unfortunately, was looking backwards as a political candidate instead of looking forward. And I think that cost the Republicans dearly. All he should have said, first of all, he shouldn't have gotten involved in primaries, first of all. Secondly, he should have said, we need to elect a Republican Congress to stop the craziness of the Biden administration because they're digging us a hole of debt and spending. And we need to restore the American Republic with free markets and limited government. That's all he had to say. And he would have, and I think the Republicans would have cashed in the Senate and the House instead of talking about the 2020 election, which really focused people on Trump as a sore loser when there appears to be substantial evidence that the election was stolen. But the point is, what are you going to do about it in 2022? Let's focus on 2022 and 2024. And I think he would walk into the nomination in 2024 if he had played the Nixon card, which is forget about the previous election and talk about what needs to be done for the American people right now with constitutional policies that would make him a hero, I think, across the political spectrum, especially civil liberties, because you know the left loves civil liberties. It doesn't seem they like it anymore because they're big fans of censorship and deplatforming people and cancel culture. So I think Trump really missed an opportunity to really become the most popular president in American history if he had just stayed on message.
Do you think he still has a chance to recover and reposition that point?
It's going to be very tough, I think. I think I saw his announcement in Mar-a-Lago, and there wasn't the type of message that I think he could have delivered. And it's going to be very tough for him because I think a lot of the insiders in the Republican Party, which were against him back in 2016, are certainly not going to be with him this time around. He still has his fan base around the country. But the question is it enough for him to get the nomination? And if it is enough to get him the nomination, how will he do in the general election if he talks again about 2020 instead of 2024 and the future of the country? So again, you've got to stay focused on a message that is a winning message. You have to appeal to independents, and independents apparently voted against Trump because that's what some of the polling shows. People in 2022 voted against Trump, which is bizarre since he wasn't on the ballot. But because he had such a high profile during the campaign, the people who didn't like Trump got energized and went to the polls and voted Democratic instead of Republican.
Let me ask you a philosophical question, and it's a broader discussion about how America will do. You know, America does what free markets do. Free markets are in trouble, America's in trouble. Free markets are good, and America's good for the most part. Now, there's downstream discussions from that, but here's the question. If we don't have honest money because the Federal Reserve sucks, because they literally create money out of thin air and then they literally charge us interest on And since they're the only source of money, they've got a monopoly. You'll never get out of debt. It's impossible with that kind of a scenario going. So if we don't have honest money, what makes us think we'll have honesty in any other aspect of our society, including elections, Doctor?
Well, that's a great point. That is really the great point. In fact, I would even tie it to something else, abortion. If people are willing to condone the destruction of human life in the womb, then the destruction of money is no big deal because it's not human life. And so I like to tie into this whole notion. What do you believe in that is of value? Is human life value? Yes, it is. Is honest money value? Yes. Is it honest products that people buy in the marketplace value? Yes. So we have to create a society where people value things. And if you don't value human life, then it's very hard to value things that we ordinarily take for granted. And it's a sad commentary in our culture how the pro-choice movement has really made the whole notion of life very, very tenuous. And that's why we see in cities around the country, district attorneys letting criminals go with no bail. This is why I'm so concerned about the future of the country, because there are people here, I believe, who would, at the drop of a hat, imprison people like they did in Germany in the 1930s.
Yes, they would.
If you don't have the proper thinking about
life in
America.
And they're trying to do that right now. Just imagine a candidate that would come out and say, ladies and gentlemen, the Federal Reserve sucks. If you want honesty in society, you got to go back to honest money. Honest weights and measures, as the Bible calls it, and you got to go back to the fundamentals of protecting life, liberty, and property. And if we protected life, the most innocent among us, we could have God smile upon us once again. That's my candidacy. I will bring back honest money, I will bring back honest elections, and I will bring back the pro-life stance that most of America is well known for and have been for decades. I almost think you could run on a simple campaign like that, Doctor, and do very well.
I think the other thing you'd add to, I'm not going to send your sons and daughters to fight wars in other countries that have nothing to do with the national security of the American people.
Maybe we need Dr. Sabrin to run for president. What do you say to that?
Well, at this stage of life, and since I'm not eligible to run for president, I'm a natural born citizen. Even though I was born under the American flag in southern Germany, I looked at the map after World War II, and the Americans controlled the area that I was born under. So maybe I am eligible, but that the last thing I would want to do at this stage of my life is crisscross the country. Your platform and other platforms in talk radio and hopefully cable TV to explain my story, to let people know about why liberty is our birthright. It's not something that government gives to us. It's our birthright. And if the politicians accepted that concept, then our problems would go away and we would have the free society that the founders envisioned for America.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Murray Sabrin. MurraySabrin.com was our guest today. We're talking about his book. He's the author of Why the Federal Reserve Sucks. Also, his newly just released autobiography, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, an American story. You know, we're talking about solutions for the country, ladies and gentlemen. Every time he gets on the air, he uses the history of understanding what an immigrant's life is like, contrasting the blessings of America, because America embraced, at least when he got here, a free market. It's changed since, and we've got to stop that erosion of our liberties. We need to understand the proper role of constitutional government. We need to understand the checks and balances, and we, the people, need to simply hold them to it. Thank you, Dr. Sabrin.
Thank you, Sam. And just to let your listeners know, at murraysabrin.substack.com, I wrote a piece today on what I'm thankful for being an American. So that's the way they can read all about my my post about being an American, at murraysabrin.substack.com.
And a huge happy Thanksgiving to all of you. For Dr. Sabrin, Sam Bushman, the Sheriff Richard Mack, and many other guests on the broadcast today, we thank all of you. And we say to you, we can preserve the nation. This nation shall endure. God save the Republic of the United States of America.